Let's go.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, where we explore purpose as a part of who we already are. We showcase all inspiring stories of the most purpose-driven people on the planet with the intention of giving you the tools to step into the potential of who you were always born to be. After all, it's in your DNA. Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. Now, in the digital age, I think it's fair to say that we are seeing so many people add speaker, thought leader, or expert to their byline. And in an age where purpose really is the new cool, often purpose expert is added to that tagline. Now, I'm in full support of that, but as someone who has kept my eye firmly on the dial with regards to the who's who of purpose, today's guest is nothing short of a master in this space. And that is why today I am interviewing him for a second time. The big difference between the first time we spoke and today is that it's fair to say the world has significantly changed in that period, and that purpose in business has taken on a whole new narrative in a world that needs hope for a better future now more so than ever before. Today's guest is Afdhel Aziz, and I can tell you he is one of the most inspiring voices in the global movement of business as a force for good. He is on a mission to solve one of the biggest problems facing companies and individuals in the 21st century, and that is how to find purpose and meaning in the work we do and unlock the power of business to do good in the world. Now, Ath is also an incredible author. He's the co-author of the best-selling book about purpose-driven brands, Good is the New Cool, Market Like You Give a Damn, and his recent release, which we will be diving into today, The Principles of Purpose. He is the co-founder and chief purpose officer at Conspiracy of Love and has advised some of the world's largest companies like Adidas, Unilever, Diageo, PepsiCo, and many, many more on how brands can do good whilst also making money. Af's a respected contributor at Forbes, and you can follow along where his weekly column covers the front lines of the purpose revolution. He interviews innovators, provocateurs, and change makers who are transforming the world for the better. Now, before we dive in, for those of you in Sydney, and I'm guessing you're probably in lockdown right now, let's hope that we can get out and about come the end of September, because the GoodCon, otherwise known as the Good is the New Cool Conference, will be a part of Sydney's Vivid Festival. Now, as we know, unfortunately, everything is quite unpredictable right now. So this is just a little bookmark to say, watch this space. Fingers crossed Vivid does happen. But if for whatever reason these events don't go ahead, please do check out goodisthenewcool.com, because you can actually become a member and gain access to a platform designed to give leaders and creators a space to connect and learn about all things good for you and good for the world. In the meantime, let's dive into a world of good right here on the podcast. Grab yourself a cup of tea, coffee, and get ready to have an amazing chat, as always, with an incredible master of purpose, but also my friend, the one and only Afdhel Aziz. Afdhel Aziz, it is amazing to have you back on what is now the DNA of Purpose podcast. Such a pleasure to have you here. My heart always feels full when I've got you beaming into the studio.
Oh, thank you, Rebecca. Right back at you. I'm so in admiration of what you're doing, flying the flag of purpose and decoding it for the rest of us out here. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, you're so welcome. Now, as I was mentioning to you just before the podcast, this series is now a part of the Future Crunch brand, and our focus is on sharing stories of intelligent optimism. And a big part of that mission is to talk to people like you who are taking ownership of the creation of a better future today. So with that in mind, I'm interested to know what world-changing idea, trend, or innovation have you recently come across that is keeping you up at night as you ponder the possibilities?
Sure. Wow, what a great place to start. So I'll tell you about an idea that's been obsessing me recently. In fact, I wrote an op-ed in Ad Age about it, which came out a couple of days ago. And it's the idea of filling the hope gap. And I wish I'd come across this before we wrote the book, because it's such a great idea, but we'd already published it before I kind of realized what was going on. So the hope gap is this thing that a bunch of researchers at Yale discovered, and it's specifically to do with climate change. And it refers to the gap caused by seeing images of dystopia and damage and destruction caused by climate change, and people feeling an inability to do anything about it. That's the hope gap, right? And that was the first time I'd ever seen it articulated like that. And it got me thinking about one big thing which is missing in the world today, and that is a narrative around climate change where we've solved the problem, right? And when we look, this is going to sound like a crazy analogy, but think about Star Trek, the TV show. And when it came out, I think you and I are kind of old enough to remember the first iterations, right? When you're seeing this kind of amazing vision of a techno-utopian, multicultural future of science and progress and humanity helping
like
the universe.
Aspirational vision.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I think there was a survey done, and a lot of people who actually ended up working for NASA and working in the space program were inspired by Star Trek to go and do it. And we're kind of missing that for climate change. We're missing a positive vision where we fixed this problem. We've figured out how to use the tools, the technology, and the will and determination of humanity to solve this problem. And because we don't have a story about that, humanity is a little bit lost, you know? And so this op-ed said, climate change is no longer a failure of science. The science did the best it could. It's now a failure of storytelling. And really what has begun to occur to me is how we need to tell a new story, and specifically how in business and culture we can tell those new stories, right? So in culture, we need James Cameron and Ridley Scott and, you know, amazing filmmakers to make movies or to make TV shows which aren't like Black Mirror and just are going to fill people with despair, but like our visions of like, no, this is how we do it. Similarly, in for brands and advertising, it's like, how do you use the power of advertising to tell humanity a new story about itself, and tell a story of optimism and hope and success? Because if we don't have that, then the only narrative we're going to buy into is one of despair. And there's actually a phenomenon called climate despair, which is just a feeling of dread, which, by the way, is leading people to not have children. Like there are now surveys which say 18 to 34 year olds are seriously considering whether to have kids or not, because they don't want to bring a young person into this world. So it's just an idea, I think, that all of us in the purpose space need to understand and figure out our own kind of way to feed into filling that hope gap, which, by the way, this particular example is about climate change, but you could apply it to anything. You could apply it to any big problem in the world out there, whether it's racial justice or income inequality or whatever that is. It just strikes me again, like your Future Crunch is about intelligent optimism, right? And so the optimist part of that is so important, because otherwise all we're going to get left with is a very pessimistic dystopian vision of the future where it's not a good looking place for humanity to exist in.
Totally. And to frame up for you the idea of intelligent optimism, our belief at Future Crunch, our motto is that if you want to change the story of the human race in the 21st century, or the story of human progress in the 21st century, you need to change the story that you tell yourself. So to lean into intelligent optimism, the stories that we actually share are the good news stories from the world of science, technology, and medicine.
The reason we do that is extremely intentional, and it sits in exactly what you're talking about, that if people are not exposed to stories of hope, are not exposed to the incredible advancements and innovations and things that are happening in the world that are changing the world in so many amazing ways today in the here and now, then it's very hard to overcome that hope gap that you're talking about. Yeah. And then to lean that back into purpose, the way I guess have integrated that in regard to an alignment to our personal purpose, that is that if we can't make a very conscious decision about the vision we choose and lining that vision with optimism, whether it be in business or whether it be on a deeply personal level, it is extremely difficult to make a decision to be the change and to be a part of the future we want to create.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Couldn't agree more. And that's why in the book, you know, Principles of Purpose, there's 27 stories of individuals, all right, in the book, who work for large multinational companies like Tesla, Patagonia, Procter & Gamble. But we deliberately didn't write 27 case studies of corporations because our firm belief is that it's in the personal that people can find a path into purpose for themselves. Mm. And the only thing that those 27 people have in common is that they are deeply ordinary, just like you and me. And we wrote it to demystify purpose as being something only for the hallowed few, and saying these people come from all backgrounds, male, female, different ethnicities, different sexual orientations. The only common thing they have is that they all made a choice at some point. And they said, I'm going to commit my work and my life to fixing this problem, whatever that problem happens to be. And simply by doing that, they unlock that deeper sense of purpose and mission, which fuels them and then in turn fuels their companies. Mm. And this is really the phenomenon we talk about as the purpose flywheel in the book.
Yeah, I had a look at the flywheel.
Yeah, that was the aha moment. We went, okay, what separates the really great purpose-driven companies from the good ones, right? What separates Tesla, Patagonia, Lego, Chobani, who I'd classify as some of the best, against ones that are good but not great? And the answer is it's the people. It's the people inside the company who are given permission to show up with their full selves, empowered to show up with their full beings and given opportunities to innovate and to find new ways of doing things that are in alignment with their purpose and their values, but are also in line with the companies and then in line with societies as well. Mm. And the only way you can do that is by creating a safe space for people so that they can show up with their full selves. Safety is survival, right? People are worried you have to create a sense of belonging. Yeah. That's the magic word, right? And without it, it's half-hearted or it's inauthentic or it never really fulfills its potential.
Mm. So, in doing my research for today's podcast, I actually had a listen to the episode that we recorded, would you believe, all the way back in 2019.
My goodness.
I know, right? And it's fair to say that was when the world was normal, opposed to what we're now maybe coining the new normal. At the time, we were discussing the power of turning points that catalyze purpose. And you had spoken in detail about your personal experience of the tsunami in Sri Lanka in, I believe, 2004, if I'm correct. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know that on a deeply personal level and in your, I guess, awakening to purpose, that this was definitely a catalyst. However, in 2020, I think it's fair to say that another tsunami hit, otherwise known as the global pandemic. I'm interested to know, as an authority on the world of purpose-driven business, how has COVID-19 evolved your perception around the role of purpose, I guess, both personally and in business?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rebecca. So, we talked about the role of trauma in triggering purpose, right? And this is incidentally, there's book number three coming, by the way. So the book one was about purpose-driven brands, book two, purpose-driven companies, and book three is purpose-driven individuals and how people in find purpose in work. And I think I spoke about how in the research we were doing, the common thread that everybody seemed to have was some sort of trauma, right? For me, it was being in Sri Lanka and narrowly missing dying in a natural disaster. Mm. For other people, it's it's somebody close to them dying or, you know, some sort of traumatic incident which triggers self-reflection and triggers a kind of a crack in the universe. And what COVID-19 is a societal level of trauma that has been shared by humanity on an unprecedented basis. Nothing else has come close. Not even world wars have come close. You could live out World War II in some tiny country in the middle of Asia, not even knowing it was going on.
Mm. Right? I mean, to consider that over 4 million people have died. Like that,
4 million people have, at that level, it's a Holocaust level event at that proportions. Mm. And if that tragedy wasn't enough, it's also something which has led to immense pain and suffering, even at non-lethal levels, right? Mm. It's touched all of us in a way that very few things have ever done before. And it's funny, you know, there used to be this old joke that the only thing that would make humanity wake up and start realizing that we're all the same would be like a giant asteroid hitting, you know, coming close to hitting the Earth. COVID-19 was that asteroid, right? And so in the middle of all of the trauma and the devastation caused by it, the fascinating thought in my head is this going to cause a global awakening of purpose on a scale that we've never seen, right? The optimist in me says yes. The realist in me says yes, but there are also going to be some people for whom it's not going to have that effect, right? Who will go back to normal or have some other reaction to it. But I have a strong feeling that it has caused a ripple effect that is not going away. And specifically in regard to business, I can tell you that in the last 12 to 18 months, the purpose movement has accelerated a hundredfold. As people inside companies have this reckoning going on and have this awakening going on, not just from COVID itself, but also the fallout, right? So here's another angle. It used to be that we had a mask that we put on before we went into work, right? We would go from being mom, dad, husband, wife, get in our cars and we drive to work. And in that time, we're putting on our mask, we're putting on our suit of armor.
Now I'm bulletproof man or woman.
I'm the VP of blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I'm like bulletproof, right?
Yeah.
That went away, right? Because we're all working from home. And so it's very hard to keep up that facade if your kid is running around underneath your feet while you're in a Zoom meeting. There's no time to put on that mask. And so there's also been this really fascinating breaking down of those walls that we've created between our work personas and our family personas. And I believe that is going to have another huge shift as well, as we begin to realize that the work that we do can either help or hinder our children's future. Right. This is the dawning realization I had. Oh my God, what if all this time when I was working hard and working for corporations and trying to earn money so I could put my kid, you know, get him healthcare and a good home and save up for his college and all that stuff. What if when I was focused on that way of being a good parent, I completely missed how my actions were leading to creating a world that would be unlivable? By not thinking about the environmental consequences of the work that I was doing, or not thinking about the societal consequences of the work that I was doing.
Or buying into all the unwritten rules in which we exist. But rules exactly you don't right. necessarily want to pass on to the next generation.
Yeah, right. Mm. And so there's going back to climate despair and people not wanting to have kids, there's a sense of guilt that they're like, oh my God, by my inaction, I may have accidentally created a world that is going to be very traumatic for my children to live in. And that's what I'm hoping that people come to terms with during COVID and go, we had a near miss with an asteroid. And I hope that woke me up enough to realize, ah, I can spend the next 20, 30, 40 years of my career inside a company continuing to perpetrate and contribute to systemic failures on an environmental level, on a systemic level. Or I can make a decision and say, whatever my job is, however small, I'm going to start. I'm going to start by injecting some purpose into it and slowly trying to influence the direction of this company or this organization to leave the world in a better state for my children as well.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I was listening to our last podcast and in that podcast, and look, there might be a trigger warning for anyone out there who has any mental health issues. Beyond Blue is a great organization. I'll just put that in there. Mm-hmm. However, you were talking in that interview about a young man who jumped off a bridge. He did try and commit suicide. Mm. He did survive. However, in the interview, you'd gone on to talk about his bus ride. I think he got on three buses to get to this particular bridge. And I might let you pick up the story and then I can loop back into why I'm sharing it in the context of the question I just asked you.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the story well. Yeah. The wonderful Maya Smith, who works for Lady Gaga's Born This Way Foundation, told a story, and it blew my mind. It was about a young man who decided to commit suicide and had to take three buses to get to this bridge that he wanted to throw himself off of. And on each bus, he was crying and in obvious distress, and no one talked to him, just ignored him. And he got to the bridge, and he was up on the kind of, you know, railing, or he was about to throw himself off, and somebody tapped him on his shoulder, and he thought, oh God, finally somebody's here to try and rescue me. And they turned around, and the person said, hey, can you take a picture of me on this bridge? And he took the picture and he jumped off the bridge and survived, you know. But the story is there to help us understand that there are people around us in obvious distress, and sometimes all it takes is a simple gesture to reach out to them that can help massively change the course of their life as well.
Yeah, it's such a powerful story. And to frame up why I mentioned that story is, I remember, I think like so many of us in the first lockdown here in Sydney, really having to kind of go on a bit of a soul searching mission, particularly with regards to what purpose was, because up until that point in time, I had very much been focused that purpose exists in the future and it's something that we're working towards, and had a whole narrative around the North Star. And if we think about the North Star, it's something that is innately up and above and outside of ourselves and something that is guiding us forward. And where I landed is, in the global pandemic, all of a sudden there are a whole bunch of really dark clouds, and that North Star wasn't quite as clear. And the shift for me was realizing exactly what you just said, that actually this North Star is something that exists within us. And it's not necessarily, whilst it can be, it's not necessarily this big overarching goal, that sometimes it's as simple as really coming into the present moment and asking, how can I help? How can I heal? How can I build hope right now in the present moment? Mm. And I think in the context of the pandemic, we really ended up in this, let me say, political straitjacket, where not only were our lives threatened, our livelihoods were threatened, but also our sense of freedom, given we were all in lockdown. And when you're standing in the middle of that, there's no room but to experience and express purpose in the present moment. I think that's something that you really tapped on beautifully in that story, but it's also something I wanted to loop back to with regards to, I guess, my shift in purpose post-pandemic, but also this idea that it's right here and it's right now. And in the context of what's happened in the world, it's probably been never been more important to step into that in a much simpler way.
Yeah, you know, when the whole world was forced into our homes and we were kind of bereft of a lot of the trappings and the distractions, I think one of the things that gave me the most hope was the people who showed up to help.
Mm.
And you saw that in so many incredible ways around the world, you know, the frontline workers, the nurses and the doctors, the people who were supporting them, the people who started, you know, looking after their neighbors, looking after their communities, cooking food, getting it to people who were food insecure. It was this avalanche of kindness, you know, that came out, right? And I think that's where we sometimes forget that purpose doesn't have to be one thing, right?
That's so true. I entirely agree with that.
You know, I was having this conversation earlier today. You know, if you think about purpose as being about finding meaning in another sense, right? People find meaning in multiple places. They find it in being a parent. They find it in being a partner, in being a neighbor, in being a member of a community organization or a member of a, you know, a religious organization, right? And what was happening in society was that a lot of those historical sources of purpose were kind of disintegrating. We don't know who our neighbors are. We don't know, you know, families are getting broken up through divorce. People aren't going to religious gatherings. And so those common sources of purpose were kind of drying up. And what COVID did was make us realize how important they were. Again, those everyday sources that weren't kind of grand, noble, overarching kind of crusades, but were just like, I'm going to bake some bread and give it to my neighbor.
Yeah.
You know,
the simple
that
things.
Little piece. Yeah. And I hope that's what I saw something which said, we hope COVID ends, but we hope what it made it do to us doesn't, in terms of us becoming a little bit more human and a bit more kind and gentle towards others and towards ourselves as well.
Mm. Yeah, just the whole notion of let us not forget. You know, as we recover, and inevitably we will. You know, humankind is extraordinary in our ability to evolve and to heal. You know, and that is a miracle. But let us not forget. And if we don't forget, then we'll hold on to those fundamental principles around kindness and compassion and all the things that you stand for, really.
Well, I wrote this, I remember writing this article a long time ago. It's probably still up on the internet somewhere.
Yeah.
Which said the sixth stage of grief is action. Right. And, you know, if you look at the classical five stages of grief, I always get them mixed up, but it's like anger, denial, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance. And it always bugged me that acceptance was the last one.
Mm.
And I think there should be a sixth stage, which is action, which is I'm going to do something about either the thing that caused me the grief or channel it into something helping somebody else. And that's what I hope we hang on to, that we had this massively traumatic event that a lot of countries, Australia included, is still going through. But what I hope comes out of it is that we don't keep circling round and around in those five stages, but we find that sixth gear, which says, all right, how do we build this society back better? How do we figure out those things that we can influence and we can control to some extent? And how do we collectively find the will to make those solutions happen?
So true. There's a great word, impassion. And the translation for the word is to take passionate action. But I also love the idea that it's kind of a fusion of empathy and compassion. And that idea of, you know, we can have empathy for what's painful, but unless we can shift that empathy into compassion and then passionate action, we can't go on a journey really into purpose, because purpose requires passionate action. Anyway, I have so much to get through with you today. I'm going to stop going down these rabbit holes because we'll be here for hours. But I just, the point is, I love talking to you because I think we're both in like our jam about, you know, talking 100%. About purpose. So,
yeah.
But nonetheless, we are here to do a deep dive into your brand new book, which is part two of the Goodies, the New Cool Chronicles, The Purpose Principles. Now, this is a book that from my perspective really unpacks not only why, but really how we as business leaders implement a purpose-driven business strategy. And that was the one thing, as I was saying to you before the podcast, that I loved. It is so practical, and it's the type of book that any leader could pick up, read, and implement. Which, you know, whilst the trends and the ideas are fabulous, if you can't make it happen, then there's no point. And this book is that solution. So I'd recommend anyone go and pick that up. Look, I have two questions here. In the book, you referenced in detail that trends that show more people care about spending their money in a meaningful way. And one of the quotes in that section that you referenced was, "Don't tell the story, be the story." I'm not sure if that was your quote or a quote from someone else, but it was in the book.
It's Russ Stoddard. Russ Stoddard, a fantastic purpose leader, runs an incredible agency called Oliver Russell. Yeah, Russ said that. I was like, Russ, that's genius.
It is genius. It is. And look, I've been thinking a lot lately about what this means, and it triggered a thought in me about an upcoming interview I have with an extraordinary frontline humanitarian by the name of Linda Cruz. And in researching her, she shared a story where she actually met Prince Charles, of all people, and they had a conversation, and his advice to her was this. He said to her, when you get the check, leave it on the table because you're going to need that check. But that's not all. What you need is the minds and the solutions of the people who are giving you the money. So with that in mind, would you consider a purpose-driven business being a business that simply hands over the check, or should purpose in business have a deeper fabric than that?
Oh, yeah, 100%. You know, the difference between corporate philanthropy and purpose is corporate philanthropy is about writing the check. True purpose-driven companies set up recurring revenue models to generate this wonderful engine of profit that keeps writing checks, come hell or high water. In fact, the whole point of a purpose-driven business is to write checks by solving the problems of the world, not by creating more problems. Right. And so that's really the, if I had to create like almost like a segmentation of purpose-driven companies, right? There may be like 0.00001% of companies on the planet for whom creating profit by solving the problems of the world is front and center their business model. Tesla is a fantastic example of this. They exist to solve an environmental problem, which is fossil fuels, right? So they're going to solve that problem without traditional corporate philanthropy or without having to think about it. Their entire business model is around solving that problem.
And it relies entirely on the brains of the people inside that organization.
One of whom we interview in the book, Sam Jafari, who is a designer at Tesla and who is a wonderful young man who worked on the Cybertruck and worked on different models. And he talks about Tesla being a place where it's religion driven by data. And he says the religion is we're all showing up because of the purpose of the company, which is to accelerate the planet's transition to fossil fuel, away from fossil fuels. And everybody's there for that goal. And the data is there to back it up, right? Now, contrast that to a traditional company who aren't really thinking about it in those terms and who are thinking about it in conventional philanthropic terms, like we're going to make widgets and occasionally we'll write a check and do some corporate kind of PR to make us look good. Which do you think is going to have a more engaged employee base? Which do you think is going to have employees who are evangelists for the company, who believe in it with the fervent kind of passionate intensity that you want, right? And so this is really the difference between business as usual And those businesses which are creating space for people to show up with their full selves as well.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's about tapping into that bottoms-up approach to engagement, isn't it?
It is. And but I think this is also why we wrote this book for the C-suite.
Mm.
And, you know, what triggered us was, if you remember, the Business Roundtable announcement
in
the U.S.
I do, yeah, in Washington, right? Yeah.
In 181 CEOs saying, we are no longer going to have shareholders as our primary stakeholder to keep happy. We're going to transition to a stakeholder model where it's about balancing the needs of employees, communities, people, the planet. And it struck us that those CEOs didn't have a guidebook to transform these giant multinational companies from being ones that were focused on profit with purpose as a little bit of like a, you know, afterthought, to becoming purpose driven in order to generate that profit. And so what we did was set out to look at all of these companies who were experimenting and kind of working with purpose in some way. None of them perfect, by the way, I hasten to add. None of these companies are perfect, just like no human being is perfect, we always say. But they were each doing something really interesting in their supply chains or their HR or their product innovation. And by going and talking to the men and women inside these companies and unpacking the how, like how are you doing this stuff, we wanted to construct a roadmap for all of these CEOs to say, okay, this is how I take my company on a journey to become truly purpose-driven as well.
Mm. So if I want to dive into, I guess, another area with regards to pricing, with regards to like purpose-driven products. And it's one that I have pondered for quite some time because, as you've noted in the book, there's, you know, there's clear evidence that people will spend money on products that are doing good in the world and that it makes them feel good about themselves and all of that sort of thing. However, in coming back to the pandemic, one of the things I did wonder, as I'm sure you did, is when people's livelihoods are affected and when there is less cash flow, does that mean that those people then don't have the money to, you know, spend the extra dollars on the keep cups or the, you know, the shoes made out of ocean plastic or whatever it might be? And in my mind, that led me to another question with regards to whether purpose was for the privileged. Are we building purpose-driven products for those of us who are in lower socioeconomic groups? So I was just interested. I don't have an answer, but I was interested as to whether you'd thought about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. So first of all, I'd say in all the research that we've shown, you still need to have a great product and a great price first.
Yeah.
Right? I think in the First Good is a New Cool book, we talked to somebody from Product Red, the incredible nonprofit social enterprise set up to tackle HIV/AIDS.
Mm.
And they would say you can't sell a bad product with a good purpose. And so they'd go into companies like Apple or The Gap and say, give us your best product and then we'll make that into a Product Red, but don't give us your terrible scratchy sweater that no one wants to buy because they're still not going to buy it. So purpose is still, I would say, a distant third in the factors that people look at when buying a product. Now, in a highly commoditized market where the product and the price are roughly the same, purpose then creates a great differentiator. You know, and the way we talk about it at Conspiracy of Love in the kind of consultancy side of the business is that, you know, in the old days, it used to be enough for a product to have share of mind, which came from a great product benefit. Tide washes whiter, right? Our product is 3 times more effective at cleaning stains than that product.
Mm.
But then that became commoditized. Then it became about having share of heart, which is a great story, and having an emotional affinity with the brand. That's where advertising kind of came around, and we started to have these kind of emotional associations. But consumers now see past that. They understand they're being manipulated, and I think it's a lot more of a higher bar that a brand needs to achieve in order to really have that emotional affinity that they're looking for. And so today we say, in order to build a great brand, You need to have a great product, which gets you share of mind, a great story, which gets you share of heart, but you also need to have great impact, which is what gets you share of spirit. That's the deepest level those companies...
When people are buying in at that soul level.
That soul level. That's the new benchmark. You can't short circuit the first two, but this is now the new benchmark, right? And I think that's where the truly authentically purpose-driven companies that people admire, they claim a share of people's spirit as well. Now, in the pandemic, I think what was fascinating was how people started holding companies accountable of how they treated their employees. And so there was fascinating data, I think it's the Edelman Trust Barometer, which looked at how one of the biggest factors that people were applying to judge companies' actions were whether they were firing people, whether they were letting them go during the pandemic, or whether they're making every effort to look after them. And I think that reflects the fact that the people being asked the questions were employees as well, right? And so they're saying, we're gonna see past your bullshit, you know, advertising campaign thanking the frontline workers.
Yeah, it's
because if the headline, next to that in the news is, and then we fired 30,000 people, you're like, well, that's just rubbish, right? So there's a new level of scrutiny that consumers have of companies, not just of what they're saying, but what they're doing. That did not exist before as well. And I think that's not going to go away. And then to answer your final question about whether purpose is for the privileged, I think it's a great one. I think that sometimes it is, and sometimes it deliberately is so. Tesla is a great example. It kind of had to build a $100,000 car first to achieve... to break into the market in order to generate enough funds to build a $80,000 car and then a $60,000 car and now a $35,000 car. So it was a very deliberate strategy to go, we're going to start at the premium end of the market, and then we're going to use that to build scale so that we can create offers at much more accessible price points for people as well. So I don't fault them for that. I think it's just what they had to do, right? But I do think what's fascinating is looking at kind of more accessible models. My other favorite example is the Impossible Burger from Burger King. Like, that's a $2, $3 burger. But creating something that shifted a massive swath of the population into a plant-based product in a fun, accessible way shows you that you can also create change at scale at much lower price points. And especially in fashion, I think right now, fashion is really interesting, right? The question I keep asking fashion brands is, can you create something that is sustainable, good quality, and cheap, like price accessible? If fast fashion, could solve that problem, so that we weren't buying, dozens and dozens of the t-shirts out there, but we're buying the right amount. But I was able to crack that holy trinity and say, we can feed the next 3 billion people about to arrive on this planet and clothe them with nutritious, delicious, sustainable food, with durable, sustainable fashion, and do it at a price point that isn't elitist.
Yeah.
All right. Now we got a ball game. That's interesting, right?
Oh, and there's so many great solutions out there that are small. I was coming into work and they're following a bus this morning, and one of the banks have a new credit card that's made out of like completely sustainable material. And I can't remember exactly what it was, whether it was like seed paper or something like that. But I was like, that's progress in action. I mean, we're walking around with all of this plastic in our wallets, and here's one tiny solution that's going to make such a big impact, because we all have credit cards or bank cards of some description. Yeah. And so I think, I think it is often in those tiny little pivots that we see great change.
Yeah. The catch-22 of purpose and business is it's about consumption, right? So people have to consume things to stay alive. Companies have to make things to consume for people to keep them in business.
Yeah.
That has kind of led to a lot of damage and destruction on the planet. Mm. If those companies can figure out how to create a truly circular, regenerative model.
Totally, which is the bigger conversation here when we're looking at the idea of purpose being for the privileged is capitalism versus a circular economy. So I'm so glad you went there because I was going to.
Cool, let's go there. Let's go there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean... Well, You go.
No, this is the next evolution, right? It's funny. I was talking to a mining company, and Australia has got lots of mining going on, right? Mm. And they said, well, what do you think is the future of our industry? And I was like, well, what happens if you think about yourself not as an extractive company, but as a circular company? Mm. You're a 100-year-old mining company. What if you said, actually, we're not going to focus only on taking things out of the ground, but we're now going to pivot our entire business model to keeping the things that we took out of the ground in permanent, usage. Mm. And there's kind of silence for about 10 seconds on the phone, on the video conferences. They kind of just process this. But to me, that's how you still solve the problem of being profitable and being something that is able to be profitable enough to give people jobs and sustain economies, but do it in a way that doesn't destroy the planet irrevocably as well.
Yeah, no, I think it. I personally believe that the idea of, you know, you donut economics, which is a book by Kate Raworth,
amazing book. Yeah,
have a look at it. It is an amazing book, and that philosophy is for me the promised land. However, until we get there, I think what is interesting is that in a way we need people with money to buy purpose-driven products and to really drive that forward, because if there's enough people buying those products, then the demand for those products goes up. Then you've got more access for everybody to those products, and eventually you would hope that all products are purpose-driven. So whilst I ask that question, at the same time, we do live in a capitalist society. So it does require people who are lucky enough to have privilege to embrace purpose even more in terms of serving the rest of the world.
Yeah. And, you know, the tagline for the book is it's time to reboot capitalism.
Yeah.
And what we mean by that is if you think about it as an operating system, right, like you have on your computer, you need to keep upgrading it. You can't just have it the way it was from 1986. Like, it would be terrible, right? And the problem is that there hasn't really been any incentive for capitalism to be rebooted because it's doing a fantastic job of keeping a very small group of people incredibly rich, right? Mm. But that's where we kind of ask this provocative question to say, well, what happens if we're able to come up with a different source code, which is purpose, to inject into this thing and say, well, what if you can take the best bits of it, the risk-taking, the ingenuity, the innovation, the scalability, and remove the worst bits, the greed, the corruption, the short-sightedness, the short-termism. Is there a way that we can then take control instead of capitalism controlling us, like we control it? Mm. And it sounds naive, right? As it sounds crazy, but There have been multiple systems before capitalism. Yeah. There was the monarchy. We got rid of that. There was feudalism and the aristocracy. We got rid of that.
Yeah, it's happened before. It'll happen again.
It's happened before. It'll happen again. And I think that's where, you know, our constituency is the women and men. And by the way, 90% of our clients in our consultancy are women. I just want to point this out, right? And they're doing incredible work inside companies to kind of hold them accountable and change things on the inside. The Achilles heel of companies is they're made up of people. Mm. And if enough people go, wait a minute, there's a different way that we can do this. We can make even more money by doing even more good. Mm. And I think that's really the experiment that we're all engaged in to say, how can we figure this out and how can we reboot this system so it creates that just and enduring and sustainable world that we all want.
Absolutely. I'm just thinking the energy revolution is a testament to what you just said and what's happening in the area of solar power at the moment.
Yeah, I have, you know, in my house here in LA, I have a Tesla parked in the front yard. I have Tesla solar panels on my roof. I'm now generating enough money and enough electricity, by the way, to sell it back to the grid. That's what's happening right now. If I look at my little app right there, and this is fascinating. It's the tools are here. This is the other thing as well. Going back to your, it doesn't have to be this kind of like far off North Star in the future. Everything we need to solve these problems are here. We just need the will.
The will and the accountability to own the future today.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think that's what we need.
And I mean, as you've just referenced, the people are starting to own that future. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, over the last few years, we saw the Me Too movement, but more recently, we also saw Black Lives Matter. And within that, it was incredible to see the rise of employee activism and brand activism. And that was quite extraordinary. That said, what we don't want off the back of these movements is for businesses to jump on a wave without the willingness or the commitment to really ground in that change. So while, you know, I think it's fair to say that these intelligent social rebellions won't be the last that we see, especially in an age where social values have a new level of velocity. But I'm curious to know, in terms of your work with clients, what's your advice to brands with regards to how they intentionally and intelligently respond to social evolution and these social movements as they emerge?
You're talking about inside the companies?
Inside the companies, brand strategy. I guess for me, I saw a lot of people really become immediately, like even watching ads, immediately so much more aware of diversity and inclusion and all of these themes, which is amazing. Let's celebrate that. But we also want to ensure these brands absolutely ground that change and that that change is authentic and has integrity and is embedded for the long run.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, one of the most fascinating aspects of writing this book is seeing what we call the rise of the activist employee.
Yeah.
And along with conscious consumers and impact investors, we talk about these are the three tectonic shifts which are affecting business, right? And activist employees are one of the most kind of riveting things to be observing right now. So these are employees who are openly standing up to their leadership publicly, protesting, walking out, striking, writing letters to the New York Times. These aren't blue-collar workers, by the way. These are white-collar tech workers who are just like, enough is enough. If you're going to tell us that your values are about respect and compassion and justice, well, you have to behave like it. And if not, we, the employees, are going to hold you accountable.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. There are companies where employees have gotten together and got the chief human resources officer fired. They have banded together in collective action and said, your actions don't reflect what we need right now. And that is fascinating to think about, this kind of rebellion that's going on, especially as you see cohorts like Gen Z and millennials enter the workforce who just have new expectations about the social contract.
And not only enter the workforce, you've got millennials stepping into leadership.
Yeah, it is fascinating to see how their values are now affecting the decisions that companies make. And so the real question you now have to ask yourself as a leader is not just how do I keep the communities and customers happy by issuing a press release now and then. It's like, how do I listen to the people inside my company who are telling me how they want to, they want this company to behave and reflect their values? There's a fascinating stat. I think it was like 68% of employees believe they have the power to force corporations to do what they want. And that CEOs should consider them as a vocal group. So it's not top down, the CEO saying, go and do this and give me quarter three returns anymore.
The hierarchy
is a whole new ball game. Yeah. It's a whole new ball game now.
So the next section of the purpose principles dovetails into how one might go about discovering their brand purpose. And often we think about brand purpose. When we think about brand purpose, the most natural starting point is to, of course, get clear on our story, which is the purpose statement. Now, it's funny because I think we've kind of spoken about this theme, but one of the points that really I loved and that really stood out to me was this idea around how we strike a balance between aspiration and precision. And we've spoken about this actually in a lot of different ways throughout the course of the podcast, but I love this because it dissects purpose as being the decision we make today to ignite the vision we have for a better tomorrow, just through my lens. So that's why I picked it. Can you share with our listeners a case study or two around how you've helped brands strike this balance in their purpose statement?
Yeah. So I can't talk about a lot of the work we do because we're under lots and lots of NDAs, but I can talk about this. This particular principle. There's a section in the book called The Seven Qualities of a Great Purpose Statement. And just for everybody's reference, a purpose statement is like a strategic statement of intent. It's the spark in the engine of a company that gives everybody a starting line that says, all right, here's what we're here to do. And it's the red thread, right? So Tesla's purpose statement is a great example: to accelerate the planet's transition to sustainable energy, right? And its precision comes from the choice of language in there. 3 years ago, it didn't say sustainable energy, it said sustainable transport. And so by changing one word in the purpose statement, it shows Tesla doesn't want to just be a car company. It wants to be a utility company. It shouldn't just be other car companies worried about Tesla. It should be electricity companies worried about Tesla, right? And so that shows you the importance of precision in a purpose statement. But at the same time, if it was precise but not inspiring, it wouldn't work. So to accelerate the planet's transition to sustainable energy, now that is aspirational, right? That's a big aspirational goal, right? And so when you think about the employees like Sam Jafari, who we interview in the book, and say, why do you want to work for this company? It's like, because they want to do that. They don't just want to be the number one car company in the world. Their aspiration is so much bigger than that. When you look at the customers who say, I want to be part of that revolution. I want to buy the car. I want to buy the solar panels. And by the way, Tesla doesn't have a marketing department, or it doesn't have any advertising agencies. It produces great content and experiences, and Lord knows putting a car into space is a fantastic marketing stunt. Right?
It's a little PR stunt.
have you ever seen a television commercial for Tesla?
No.
Right? And so that's the power of having a great purpose and translating it into product and intention and having every single employee being an evangelist for it. You can feel the authenticity of it. Your listeners will say there's lots of things wrong with Tesla, and there are flaws and faults in its model and working conditions. Lots of things you can point fingers at. So please don't take this to be a blanket kind of endorsement. Again, no company is perfect, just like no human being is perfect. But by having that purpose statement so clear and having it then translate into every aspect of what this company does, it shows you the importance of both aspiration and precision as well.
And I mean, I'm darting around a little bit because I'm going to jump forward to the part in the book where you talk about the competitive advantage with regards to really getting clear on your niche purpose as a brand. But the reason I'm jumping forward to this question is because I've referred specifically to Tesla and electric cars, because when it comes to this idea of having a competitive advantage. Nothing beats disrupting the mechanisms of an entire industry by coming up with a completely new product design like an electric car. And I understand now many of the other car companies are having to follow along and develop electric cars to catch up. So when we're looking at the competitive advantage of purpose, what would your advice be maybe for leaders in looking at that next big disruptive purpose move? How might you go about, you know, I don't know, embracing an Elon Musk mindset? Possibly.
Maybe smoke a lot of cannabis and go on the Joe Rogan.
Yes. He did it the second time, though.
I love the insanity of that man. But I think, you know, what's interesting about purpose is that it can not only tell a story of where you've come from, but it can also really beautifully frame where you need to get to, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where thinking about a purpose statement as a statement of future intent is also a really powerful way to unlock new possibilities and growth in ways that you wouldn't have thought about, you know, if you hadn't gone through the exercise of thinking about it. And the example that's coming to mind right now is actually another car company, which is Toyota, which has framed its purpose around mobility. And when you look at that kind of, first of all, you go, well, of course, Toyota is a, you know, a car company. So it should be around cars, and cars are mobile. But if you go and look underneath the hood, no pun intended, of what they're talking about, they are really thinking about mobility in a much bigger way than just cars. They're thinking about mobility in a much more holistic sense, from personal mobility, you know, to all the way to societal mobility. And so by expanding the definition of themselves from a car company to a mobility company, suddenly you start to see the adjacencies and different categories and different opportunities that they could get into. And that's how a really sharply articulated purpose statement can really help unleash profound transformation as well, if you do it the right way.
Do you think we'll start seeing more partnerships with regards to these kind of big, innovative, disruptive moves, such as something like building entirely new models? You know, to give that context, we're seeing a lot of partnerships, say, between charities and brands, and that's an amazing step forward. But to give you an example, like here in Australia, because we've got quite a small, I guess, charity market, sometimes what you see is 10 charities doing exactly the same thing, solving exactly the same product, but they're all competing against each other for market share. And if we look at that in terms of business, wouldn't it make sense for businesses, say, in similar industries to collaborate and really pick a game-changing idea or innovation and work together to get to that next level?
Yeah, 100%. So it's a principle that we talk about in the book called purpose should be an open source pursuit.
Yeah.
And what we mean by that is at a certain level, even though businesses might be competitors in a commercial sense, they're collaborators in a societal sense.
That's right. Yeah.
And by taking collective action, they can have profound changes in the way that they affect humanity.
I mean, we saw it with the vaccine and just the way scientists collaborated.
Yeah, we saw it with the vaccine. You know, an example is I don't know why we're talking about car companies all the time, but Volvo and safety data. We have a car theme on this podcast, Rebecca. Volvo had a wonderful project called Project Eva, which was around sharing safety belt data or seatbelt data around safety. And the insight that they had was most safety data is built around the male anatomy, which didn't really help women in car crashes because their bodies are built differently. Volvo happened to have several decades of female anatomy data, and they released it and said, here you go. Every car company on the planet, now you can access this data. And that's what we mean about creating an open source approach where yeah. you can share things which you'd normally think are competitive, but it's for the greater good.
Yeah, it puts humanity first.
It puts humanity first. And you see this happen again. Patagonia does this with their technology innovation around materials and things like animal welfare standards. By just doing, being the pioneer, doing the work first, and then going, all right, everybody else, it's for the good of the world. That's how we think businesses should behave in a collaborative fashion.
Mm. Yeah, fascinating. I think it'll be incredible to watch this space in the coming years. So we're nearly at the end, Alf. I've got two more questions just to let you know, because I'm very aware of how precious your time is working with these incredible brands. In the last section of the book, you go into detail on the 9 principles of purpose in business. And I would love to go into all of these in more detail, but you know, we might need to do a third interview for that one. Love to have you back in my DNA of purpose, carpool karaoke, yeah. since we've been doing cars. But I'd love to know, what principles are you most passionate about sharing?
Ooh, that's a good one. Hang on. I need to look at the book. Just refresh myself.
Get the pages out. Well, it is a very in-depth, detailed book. So
lots in there. Writing about purpose is like writing about digital. The more you start writing, you're like, oh my God, we need to talk about this and talk about that.
Oh, there's so many aspects, hence why I could have you on this podcast for hours.
I think, you know, if I had to pick one that I think is really powerful to end on, it's about measurement. Let's talk about that. It's not the sexiest thing in the world, but there's a principle in there called purpose must measure what you treasure. And this is a topic that comes up again and again and again. How do you measure the ROI of purpose? And I've written about this, and you can find my stuff online in it. The problem we identified is that purpose is scattered across multiple silos. And you need to have a holistic way of measuring the return of a purpose initiative, right? So you need to look at it in a multidimensional way. And as a company, you need to create a kind of a bespoke, customized model to measure it properly. Let's take an example that we just talked about, right? The Volvo safety data, right? So releasing that data may have a positive impact on the Volvo brand, right? So over in the marketing department silo, you better be tracking that and saying, oh, actually, you know what? This has led to a positive uplift in people associating Volvo with safety, or Volvo as a socially conscious company. Then you look at employees and say, whoa, has this made our employees prouder to work here? How has it led to reduction in employee turnover or an increase in employee engagement? And let's measure that. How does it lead to profitability? More people deciding to buy Volvo cars because this has increased the association with safety as another reason for us. What has it done to our community reputation, to our corporate reputation? Mm-hmm. If you're a publicly listed company, how does it affect our share price? And so suddenly, once you start to look at all of these different variables and all of these different kind of indicators, how do you put them all together to say the cumulative effect of that is how we measure the impact of this purpose initiative? That's the missing link. And until we start doing that properly, it's going to be really hard to justify the ROI of purpose, because it is hidden, and it's hidden in so many different silos across the company as well.
So it requires a new level of measurement. Yeah. The return on impact next to the return on investment.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, that's another fascinating topic itself. How does a corporation measure the value of the societal impact that it's created and factor that in? If Volvo releasing that data led to 12% less injuries for women in car crashes across the automobile industry, how do you take credit for that?
Yeah.
In order to justify going through the expense of putting it all together. So this is a topic I think we're just scratching the surface of, but there's a wonderful company, by the way, in Australia called Rooy, R-O-O-Y. Shout out to Tim O'Brien. They're the masters of this. You should have Tim on this podcast.
Amazing.
By the way.
Yo, hook me up.
Tim, come on this podcast. You'll have a great conversation about this.
I would love that. I would love that. So I've come to the last question today, and it's simply this. You have written a book for leaders, and in writing a book, you are in essence a storyteller for the future, for the creation of a future we're proud of. So with that in mind, what is the one story that you feel is the most significant in order to ignite human progress for the 21st century?
The one story in the book, or just the one story
just
in
broadly in your heart? In your heart.
Well, I link it back to the word leadership that you just talked about. Yeah. And we spent a lot of time thinking about this word because for us, leadership isn't a title. It's nothing to do with the seniority. It's nothing to do with, you know, your position or your job title. It's to do with an attitude. You can be a 19-year-old intern in your first day of the job at a company and be a leader at that company. Leadership is about taking that action. So it's important to contextualize that word. And the story that we end the book with actually is probably a good way to exemplify that idea. It's the story of this thing called the trim tab. And the trim tab is the tiny, tiny rudder on top of the main rudder that changes the direction of the boat. So if you imagine like a giant, like Titanic sized cruise ship, the rudder has a rudder.
Yeah.
And the tiniest rudder, the trim tab, can have an enormously outsizedly proportionate effect.
Mm. I've got an image of one of those big cruise liners turning 90 degrees.
Turning, yeah. Right? You are the trim tab. You can be that trim tab. You can be a leader at whatever level that you are in. And that's what we want people to remember, that we all have some agency. We can all make some impact. Don't wait until you think you're at a certain position of power. You already have the power. Mm. And so that is the story I'd say I'd leave you with. Think about yourself as the trim tab and think about yourself as a leader as you start to think about how you can take action as well.
What a wonderful analogy. And maybe start with the purpose principles. Good is the new cool, the purpose principles, because it will show you how. Af, where can we get the book?
You can buy it on Amazon. It's available globally. It's in the Amazon Australia bookstore. Please also check out, there's a companion podcast series called The Field Recordings.
Oh, amazing.
Where six of the people that we interview, we happen to have on audio. So you can hear the actual voices, some of the incredible people that we met from companies like Mattel and Patagonia and Tom's. So please check that out as well. And then keep your eyes open for GoodCon Australia coming soon, at a time and date that Rebecca is going to reveal once we have
definitely
some clarity around
it as well. I will certainly be mentioning it, you know, in the intro for this podcast when we go live, and I will just mention it in the intro of the podcast until September, because it's, you know, GoodCon is an event that I would want anybody listening to this podcast who are passionate about purpose, and if you live in Sydney, you should be there, definitely. So, and run by some of the nicest humans on the planet, I will say.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's just always such a pleasure. Yeah, as I said at the beginning, my heart is full. Thank you so much, Afdel Aziz.
Thank you, Rebecca, for creating space to have these conversations. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And can't wait back to come back and do more carpool karaoke with you at some point as well.
You're on. Lock it in.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like updates on upcoming episodes as they are released, in addition to good news posts from the world of science and technology, please follow along at our Instagram page, which is at DNA of Purpose Podcast, or sign up to our newsletter at futurecrunch.com. You can also download our brand new ebook on the Great Transformation, which is available at our website. And these links are also included in the show notes. You can think of the Great Transformation document as your field guide to the next economy.